Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Ethos Capital's update. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions when prompted. For the benefit of other participants who have joined via the HD web phone, please ensure that you've given your microphone permission to make yourself audible before accessing the question queue. For the benefit of other participants who have joined via the webcast, you're welcome to pose your questions in the questions box provided on your screen. If you should need assistance during the call, please signal an operator by pressing star and then zero. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I would now like to hand the conference over to Mr. Peter Hayward-Butt. Please go ahead, sir.
Thanks very much. And again, thank you very much to all our investors for taking the time. I don't think we'll need the full hour. We don't normally, obviously, do a quarterly update, but we just thought, given the changes that have happened over the last 3 months or so, predominantly due to COVID, it would be useful. And a number of our investors have been asking us, you know, what have we been doing in this period of time across our portfolios to deal with the COVID issues? So the purpose of today is to just give you an update on the portfolio and the outlook, but probably more pertinently is just to delve into exactly what we've been doing across our portfolio companies. I've been joined by Antonie de Beer, who's the managing partner of our large equity program. And whilst we've been doing relatively similar things across all of the funds, it's largely been driven by the large equity fund. So I've asked Antonie to spend a bit of time just focusing on, you know, what have we been doing. I've also been joined by Roger Grobler, who is the senior partner in our AI fund. As many of you know, Channel Vast and Vertice are two key assets that sit in that fund. So I've again asked Roger to spend a bit of time focusing on that. So that'll save you from listening to my dulcet tones for, you know, for the full hour. But just to give some sort of update, I mean, obviously, I think we've sort of largely forgotten that, you know, how tough the back end of 2019 and the start of 2020 had been, you know, both from a GDP, consumer confidence perspective. All that seems to have, you know, long forgotten. In fact, we wish for those days to return. But the impact of COVID has been pretty significant across the portfolio. And we'll go through it in a bit more detail across some of our key portfolio companies, but it's probably more interesting for investors to say, you know, what did we do when COVID first hit? Where are we in that journey, and what's the outlook? And it's not all negative. You know, I think a lot of the COVID discussion and rhetoric is negative, but there's a number of positive points that come out of it, and Antonie will touch on a bit of that. From a valuation perspective, you'll see that we've written the portfolio down from an NAV per share perspective. Ethos Capital's NAV per share is 8.91. If you use the Brait NAV, so i.e. on a look-through basis, if you want to include, you know, Brait at the current share price, then the NAV for Ethos Capital is around 6.65. But obviously that has a double impact. You're counting the discount twice. So, you know, an NAV per share of 8.91 down from 11.48, you know, as of December, you know, we'll unpack a bit of that for the investors. But I think it's pretty important to say, how did we approach valuation in this quarter? It wasn't easy. There were a lot of moving parts. We obviously had to do it based on a 31st of March valuation. And we really looked at it across three different buckets. The first one was a multiples bucket. Clearly, most peer groups had decreased. I think across the world, 31st of March was probably the low point in most companies' share prices. But we obviously had to market to market as at the 31st of March. So we'll see quite a significant impact from a lower multiples. What we also tried to ascertain, which is difficult in some cases, easier than others, is what was the longer term or sort of the medium term outlook for the business post-COVID. So in a post-COVID world, you know, what was the likely outcome? If pre-COVID you made 100 million rand of EBITDA, what was the outlook post-COVID? And pretty much across the board, you know, we took a relatively conservative view that in most cases, you know, EBITDA, certainly in the shorter term, would likely to be down year on year, and we made that adjustment as of the 31st of March. So in some cases, we took a normalization adjustment to the actual LTM and wrote the EBITDA down by a certain percentage, and we'll again touch on that. And then finally, I think one of the things that the market seems to miss is that many of these companies will require significant working capital to get up and running again, and in addition to that, you know, many of the companies may not have been paying certain costs, but those accrued costs will need to be caught up, you know, whether those be deferred rents and the like. And again, we made that adjustment to net debt numbers. So if, for example, your net debt was actually 100 million as of the 31st of March, but there were going to be accrued losses until opening of, 20-odd million rand, we would have written the debt up to 120. So across those three factors, you know, there's a relatively significant impact on the valuations. The unlisted portfolio, so effectively that's the old Ethos Capital portfolio, excluding MTN, was down just under 20%, around 17%. The Brait valuation decreased by just over 50% from a share price perspective. Its share price fell significantly post our entry in January. And that led to an NAV per share of 8.91, as I mentioned before, down from 11.48 in the previous quarter. I'll hand over to Ntuni just to talk a bit through, you know, our response to COVID, what have we been doing across our funds, and what the outlook is for the portfolio.
Thank you, Peter, and good afternoon, everybody. I think we've got in the large equity fund program, we've got a large exposure to a number of businesses. I think Ethos Capital has got exposure to some of them. But I wanted to give you guys a sense on the first two slides, just exactly how we approached the crisis once it hit. You know, we are on slide five, and our first week when we entered lockdown, a huge amount of focus and energy went into business continuity and making sure that all of these businesses were ready with the business continuity plans. The benefit of having a large portfolio is that you see a wide range of responses to the crisis, from excellent and outstanding management teams dealing with it diligently and massively disciplined in a disciplined way, to companies that may not be completely ready for the challenges that were coming there, heading their way. So what we did was actually create a framework of around 55 questions that we received or benefits that we received from experiences across the portfolio, and then we're able to bucket it into six categories and then share those learnings with a broader portfolio management teams. It really focused on the financial and liquidity issues. It focused on some commercial questions and operational questions, some legal and insurance matters that companies needed to deal with. And then a huge amount of effort also went into the human resources element of this. How do you deal with leave policies? How do you deal with managing staff and working from home? You know, how do you make sure that your employees are effective and efficient when they're not at work? And how do you also deal with the opening and closing and partial opening and closing of businesses? So all of those learnings in week one we shared across the portfolio, which was well received by portfolio company CEOs and CFOs who were on those calls. When we entered week two, it became very clear that once you've focused and you've dealt with the business continuity issues, you were now into liquidity management and a huge amount of effort there again into the modeling of what liquidity will be needed if your portfolio company or the company actually only generates X amount of revenues. So what you can see on the slide there in that middle column was really just a liquidity stress test that we created by business, really saying we don't know where the trading is going to end for a company. But if the revenues were down 10%, 20%, 30%, 70%, 100%, what would the implications be of that stress test on the actual cash flows in the business and the liquidity? And therefore, if we were looking at facilities in companies, were those facilities enough, or did we actually have to go out there and start securing some additional liquidity facilities for the companies? I think what that also emphasized for us was the key elements of the fixed costs in businesses and what key levers had to be pulled in those companies. So a lot of focus and energy went into the salaries and wages and what you can do with salaries and wages, and a huge amount of efforts into your rental paid, and then the engagement with the lenders and the financiers around what do you do with interest payments, what do you do with capital repayments. So we too focused on getting those liquidity models up and running and making sure that all of these businesses were ready to model their liquidity and cash flows on a short-term basis. Week three then moved into staring at the capital structures of companies and saying, you know, are these capital structures fit for purpose? That work is ongoing, and as we turn over to the next slide, you'll see some further work going on in that. But a crucial element for us in these companies are that you've got to make sure that the company's balance sheets are appropriate. If they're not appropriate, you've got to go and fix those balance sheets. And you've got to figure out the best mechanism through which to fix those balance sheets, whether it's through a capital debt restructure, or whether it's through equity support, or whether it's actually through delaying of capital expenditure as well as expenses in companies to make sure that they create sufficient liquidity in those companies. But a lot of work then has to go into what are the medium-term capital restructures that are needed to set a company up for success. I think we started that process in week three, and then eventually we started focusing also on the conversations with our management teams around how do you exit this lockdown? How's your company positioned for the longer-term strategies if COVID is, you know, the implications of COVID are absorbed in the economy? How is your company still going to win going forward? Moving into week four plus or the next quarter work, just to add to that, so our liquidity management focus remains. We are staring at our businesses and looking at which ones need what type of capital, and clearly capital allocation is a key element for us in making sure that we allocate our capital and our investors' capital in the most effective and efficient way. Our balance sheet restructures, we've engaged with all of the lenders in the market, with the top management in those banks, to make sure that we, in partnership with them, find the most appropriate and the best solutions for companies where needed. And then I guess the last piece of it is to get companies now ready for the next 3 to 5 years, you've got to make sure that they've got their plans and strategies ready to go out there and grab market share where they can, to consolidate where they can, and to have a management team and management teams that are incentivized and motivated to go out there and do it. Clearly, there's been a massive uncontrollable year as far as the COVID-19 is concerned. And what we can do is to make sure that we've used all the controllable factors we do have to set these companies up for success and make sure they win. And that's where I think the longer term incentives are going to be absolutely crucial. Last 2 points before I'll hand back to Peter is just as we entered this crisis, the Ethos Capital portfolio was sitting in a fairly comfortable debt to EBITDA level. The leverage on the balance sheet was comfortable as far as we are concerned. It was sitting around 2.5 times, and that sort of is a level where we're very comfortable to manage these assets and to run them to exit. You can see also there that a large part of the portfolio was still trading under lockdown, 29% in partial lockdown, and 17% of the Ethos Capital portfolio was completely locked down during that shutdown phase. So that 17% would have been impacted quite severely by the lockdown, whereas the other two elements of the portfolio still were able to trade and generate some cash flows.
Thanks, Anthony. And I think what's probably important to say is, you know, I think sitting in the first couple of weeks of COVID with the massive uncertainty and limited transparency, I guess we were probably conservative in our outlook, which has been a positive, I think. I think if you talk about cost rationalization across the portfolio, you know, one thing COVID has done is focus management's mind on operational leverage as well as financial leverage. And I think we've seen a number of cost-cutting initiatives that probably we wouldn't have seen, you know, if COVID hadn't come along. So, you know, partly getting up, you know, getting ahead of the curve here and saying to the management teams, guys, really, we've got to move the needle here to survive, you know, has been a positive. And I think coming out of COVID, the performance has been probably ahead of where we expected it to. So, i.e., you know, businesses have come back slightly quicker than we would have expected. So the lockdown was slightly shorter in most cases for companies. Their performance thereafter has been slightly better. But it's a long road back from here. And we do think there's going to be an element of survivor's bias. There were many of our industries that had, you know, independents, low-cost operators, you know, eating at the fringes of those sectors. You know, those guys have largely, to a large extent, gone away. They won't have survived. And I think it will change the competitive dynamic for those businesses going forward. So, you know, lots of doom and gloom, but not all doom and gloom. Just quickly on the portfolio update, so on slide 8, 82% of our portfolio sits within 8 assets, and we'll talk a bit about those portfolio companies today. This categorization is based on the NAV as of the 31st of March, and assuming the Brait share price, so not the NAV. So you'll see Virgin is obviously reduced from, I think, just under 20-odd% to 13% of the portfolio, and Premier is at 9% of the portfolio. Channel VAS remains a very large part of the portfolio. Roger's going to touch on Channel VAS and Vertice over the page. Both assets have performed very well. We're very pleased with those assets, and to a large extent have been somewhat COVID agnostic, and have continued to perform well. But there have been portfolio companies such as Virgin, as we know, and I'll touch a bit on that later, which have been massively impacted by COVID, having to shut globally all of their gyms. So it's a bit of a tale of different cities, and we'll try and touch on each of these portfolio companies as we go. The geographic split, as we show on the left, is still about 50-odd%, SA-based, a very significant component, the rest of sub-Saharan Africa, and a large component of that, resides in Channel VAS and Echo. And obviously, you've still got a component of international, which is largely driven out of Iceland, which we've now sold, and obviously Virgin as well. So I'll hand over to Roger to talk about Channel VAS first.
Thanks, Peter. Peter, just confirm that you can hear me?
Yeah, got you.
Thanks. Good afternoon, everybody. On Channel VAS and Vertice, what I want to do for a few minutes on each is just to briefly review the strategy of the business and talk about in the short term the impact of COVID and then the long-term impact on both of those businesses. I think it's quite important to just understand the strategy as a first go. Channel VAS is a business that is sort of well understood by almost thinking of it as a sort of a meta telco play. They sit across 19 different telcos across 30 different countries. So they see data and behaviors in the airtime lending space that an individual telco will not see. And due to the benefits of technology that they've got, they only have sort of 5 integrations to do into core systems of the telcos. When we invested into Channel VAS, we not only found the ACS, or the airtime lending platform, very powerful. It's a very extremely profitable, extremely stable, high growth strategy, but we also like the fact that there's a platform for other financial services. So micro lending, unsecured small micro loans into the platform, as well as potential insurance. Having gotten involved in the business, we've seen how strong the airtime lending component is, and we've actually had quite a few discussions with the team there as to whether that should not be their primary play in terms of making the most out of that ACS business, because they're by far the market leader globally in it, and so the second player is not even close. So if we look at what COVID has done, if you look across all industries, telco is probably one of the strongest, if not the strongest industry coming out of COVID, and has benefited greatly from COVID due to the increased demand for communication. So the underlying telco clients are generally doing extremely well, and the demand for Channel VAS services has gone up because of people being in lockdown. They need to get access to airtime, and that has stood them in good stead. The little bit of downside on that is obviously people then also struggle to go and top up, so in terms of money coming back. But to date, Channel VAS is trading very strong under COVID. The one thing that is struggling a bit is sort of new deployments, and that's largely due to sort of just the lack of being able to travel and actually to go and see clients. But in most of their markets, they are going from strength to strength. I was in a quite a senior meeting with Vodacom executives on a different topic not long ago, and they described Channel VAS as the best business partnership that they've ever seen, which was quite nice to hear. And then in the long term, from a Channel VAS perspective, to see how stable that business is quite incredible. I think from an investment perspective, there's good growth ahead. The risk is relatively low. The big swinger for me on Channel VAS is what the exit would look like one day. And it either might be a sort of a similar exit to the way that we came in, and might be some private equity players that buy in on a multiple. I think there is some upside in terms of a large financial services player buying in at a very attractive valuation, just based on the fact that there's a very strong emerging markets financial services distribution platform, which is quite good. So I'll move on to Vertice, and just again on strategy, the Vertice strategy has been a buy and build strategy. We've done six acquisitions before COVID. Quite interesting acquisitions in that we would buy a player in a specific medical vertical. It will typically be founder, owner, operated. The founder would join the Vertice team. We bought these businesses at relatively low multiples. They would come on board still running their business, still being very empowered to run their business, get access to financial systems and all kinds of sort of central office support. And that has gone very, very well. And the culture in the business is very strong. In COVID, we've done two small acquisitions, and I think there will be some more as a result of COVID due to people, businesses taking strain. And we've got one fairly large acquisition that is fairly long down the track that gives us access to a whole bunch of health tech assets into Vertice. So in the Vertice business itself, it's a bunch of quite traditional medical distribution businesses that we are adding some AI-enabled products and services to. The biggest single sort of competitive advantage, I think, that sits in Vertice is the distribution platform into the healthcare industry, and that they are trusted by specialists and doctors, and therefore the introduction of new products and services is quite expedient doing it through Vertice. In terms of the COVID impact on Vertice, I think there's a very clear sort of a short-term and a longer-term impact to consider. In the short-term, there are some of the divisions that have experienced quite a severe drop, and that's where there's elective surgeries. And there's some divisions that are trading like three times their budget, and those are mostly the people that sell personal protective equipment and the like, things that's needed by COVID. The question on the drop in revenue during COVID is the extent to which that has just created pent-up demand. In our discussions with specialists, I mean, we are very aligned with the specialists. The specialists' volumes have gone down. Their own revenue have gone down. So what we've heard is that they stacking their patient lists up quite strongly for when lockdown reduces. So we do think that some of that pent-up demand will come back in the months with lesser lockdown. And then in the longer term, there's some very interesting changes in the healthcare industry from a digitalization perspective that have taken weeks and months now, changes that were expected to take years otherwise, and that plays quite well into our offering that we've got in Vertice. There's obviously a general health awareness globally that is coming as a result of the virus, and we expect that to drive increased spend in the health space. And there is expected to be quite a sort of public health expansion to strengthen the public health frameworks and infrastructures in different countries.
Roger? We lost Roger. Okay.
We seem to have lost this line. Yeah. I'll reconnect in a moment. Thank you.
No problem. I'll just take it. So just quickly just talk about Channel VAS before we move on to give anyone context on the valuations. On a year-to-date basis, EBITDA grew north of 20%, north of 22% actually. So it had a very strong growth in EBITDA year on year, which was pleasing, slightly ahead of budget, you know, for ourselves from, you know, our perspective. But very importantly, in the third quarter, we took a decision to decrease the sustainable EBITDA by about 9% in the third quarter. And the reason we did that at the time, the Naira was at the time where you could get oil for free. The Naira had blown out to 5.30 from, you know, the exchange rate of 3.60, which we had originally modeled the business on. And so we took a decision to normalize the EBITDA in the third quarter, you know, based off a much higher exchange rate, reflecting the fact that those Naira well, that Naira EBITDA from the Nigerian business would be translated at a high exchange rate. It hasn't actually eventuated, to be honest. The exchange rates remain, the official exchange rate, around the 360, and even the 1 year forward has come back to about 430. So maybe we were slightly conservative, but in terms of valuation quarter on quarter, that 9% reduction in EBITDA, which we made as a normalization adjustment, will reflect in the valuation, i.e. the valuation was down around 9% for the quarter. So again, might be, we kept the multiple the same. The net debt was slightly better. There was a bit of cash in the business, but having reduced the sustainable, what we thought was a sustainable EBITDA level by 9%, the valuation was down somewhat. Then just touching on Vertice from a value perspective, on the last 12 months, we've grown EBITDA by more than 200%. A large component of that is also by acquisition. So organically, the business has grown very well, as Roger alluded to. But pretty importantly, we've added a couple of, you know, verticals to that, which has grown EBITDA by north of 200%. Again, from a, maybe it's a conservative perspective, at the end of the third quarter in March, we increased the debt for the closure period. So we assumed that there would be some costs accrued over that period of time, and we increased the net debt as at the end of March, which resulted in a valuation reduction of that business of just over 7%. So again, despite its strong performance, we took a view to reduce the valuation of that portfolio. In terms of Synerlytic is the wear check business that we bought from Tor Industries. Performed very strongly in the lead up to March, had a very, very strong first quarter to the year up until sort of midway through March. The business was a non-essential service provider, so in lockdown, many of its clients, but also it had to cease trading across most of its business. That said, since the lockdown has opened up, it's back in full operation and performing slightly ahead of our lockdown expectations, as I alluded to earlier. And there were very significant cost-saving initiatives driven during the last 2 months, which, once we come out the other end of this current trading, should stand the business in pretty good stead. Again, we took a decision to write down the sustainable EBITDA down by just under 10% to give you some idea. So the business made before, we took a view that coming out of COVID, it was going to take longer to get back, and that impacted the valuation by around about 10%, really a reflection on the lower EBITDA in this business as at the end of March. Moving on to Virgin Active, I'm sure many of you would have listened to the break presentation. Virgin, up until the end of February, performed very, very strongly, both in 2019, where it grew EBITDA by about 8%. In the first 2 months of the year, it added as many customers as it did in the full, as many members as it did in the full year, the year before, so it was performing relatively well. And obviously, as a result of COVID, well, it was very significantly impacted. About midway, well, beginning of March, they closed the Italian gyms, and mid-March, they closed the rest of their global gyms. We have seen the gyms opening up. So Italy opened up probably just over 5 weeks ago, and we've seen usage in that area come back to about 60 to 65%, which has been very pleasing. If you take the Thailand and Australian operations, again, similarly, usage, particularly in the suburban gyms, have been very good, and we're pleased with that. If the UK is likely to open up, our best estimate is likely to open up towards the end of July. And the key business that we need to get opened up is obviously the South African business. We are engaging with government still on that. And clearly, whilst we believe we're making progress, we need the protocols to be signed off by government, which are sitting on the DTI's desk as we speak. So the business was performing well. Lots of initiatives that management had taken during the course of the year to really reposition the business and take costs out of it. And we're pretty confident that particularly in this business, there will be an element of survivor's bias. There have been a number of lower-cost or uncapitalized low-cost gyms who've fallen by the wayside, who were, particularly in the UK context, you know, eating at the edges of Virgin's offering in the UK. So broadly, from a Virgin perspective, very significant impact on the NAV. You will have seen in the break results, we wrote the NAV down relatively significantly in this business. But we're relatively hopeful that we have recapitalized the business in the right way, and there will be an element of survivor's bias once the business comes out of lockdown. Moving on to Echo, I think Roger alluded to, you know, the ICT space and telcos in particular. telco services has been a net beneficiary of COVID, and I don't think Echo is much different. Its sales pipeline, you know, continues to remain strong. Their customers are increasingly looking for cost-efficient solutions, particularly on a post-COVID world, with requirements for new products from working from home, et cetera. So this business is well positioned for that. As you know, we doubled the size of the business at the back end of last year by buying the Sub-Saharan African portfolio. The only downside has been of COVID is we haven't really been able to get into those countries to expedite the integration. But it does continue. We are driving it, but it's likely to take a bit longer. But I think the group is very well positioned, very, very strong management team. The KPIs are all pointing in the right direction there. And from a value perspective, there wasn't much impact on the valuation quarter on quarter. We didn't write it up despite the nearly doubling of the sales pipeline. We thought it prudent to keep it pretty much where it was in the quarter before. Moving on to Premier. Premier obviously sits in the Brait stable. Premier had a very, very strong performance again during the 12 months to March. It was up 7% from an EBITDA perspective, you know, excluding exceptionals. And they had a very good start to the first 2 months of the year. The EBITDA was up 18%. It's been a slight beneficiary of COVID in the fact that certainly our market shares have increased in the bread and milling space. And the operational efficiencies with management have been working on for the last 12 months or so, you know, were reflected in this year's numbers. They saved on an annualized basis nearly 200 million of costs in a business that makes EBITDA of about a billion rand. So, you know, very significant beneficiary of, you know, of operational efficiencies. And the market share, pleasingly across just about every category, you know, of importance in the group was up year on year, which was pleasing. That said, you know, we're very mindful of the fact that, you know, COVID is going to bring incremental costs into the business. We'd be provisioning for that. But particularly if you take, you know, costs of incentivizing your staff to work, additional health and safety requirements that are required, et cetera, and impacts on the supply chain. You know, we've provisioned both at the back end of last year and also in the first couple of months of this year for incremental costs in this business. But so far, so good. It's performing very well. And as I said, EBITDA was up 18% in the first 2 months of the year. Moving on to Kevro and Primedia, this is the opposite story of some of the ones that we've talked about already. These two businesses were very significantly impacted by COVID, some, to be honest, by own goals, particularly in the form of Kevro. So Kevro was impacted firstly in COVID, initially from a supply chain perspective. You know, trying to get stuff in from China was more difficult at the onset of the pandemic. Admittedly, they managed to sort most of those issues out, you know, relatively quickly with China coming on stream. But what hit the company was they were trying to do two things at once, and they embarked upon a consolidation of their distribution centers into one center at the same time as doing a new IT integration project. I think trying to do either of those at one time was probably difficult. Trying to do both at one time during COVID has ended up being, you know, very, very difficult and problematic for the business. So, you know, that business had a very tough first quarter, and it's continued into the second quarter as we expected. It is looking slightly better as we speak now, and things are probably slightly ahead of our expectations. But certainly for the first half of this year, you know, Kevro was impacted. And I would say that is a business that's been impacted by own goals as well as COVID. It's not something we can only blame on COVID there. And the valuation of this business quarter on quarter was down nearly 50%, 50%. And if I had to sort of break it down for you, of that 50, 20% was due to a lower multiple which we put on the business. About 20% was due to a lower sustainable EBITDA that we reflected in the business, and about 10% was incremental costs and working capital we thought was required to get the business up and running once the IT integration had happened. So a very significant valuation reduction, you know, in Kevro. As I said, importantly, we've brought a new management team there, the new acting CEO. They've done a great job, and the business actually is starting to perform well. It's not a demand-side issue. In fact, demand, even during the crisis, held up very strongly. It's certainly, from our perspective, you know, supply-side issue and making sure that we can supply the demand that's in the market. So we're hopeful that, you know, that can get back to form relatively quickly, and we've seen that certainly during the course of the last month or so, volumes have picked up. The other business that's been impacted pretty significantly by COVID is Primedia. As you would expect, advertising globally has been down somewhere between 30 and 50%, not just in South Africa, but across the globe. And Primedia certainly hasn't been spared from that perspective. Its outdoor business has been obviously impacted to quite a significant extent, But even the broadcasting business, you know, people have pulled back on advertising. Certainly high spend advertising, which is the spend that happens across our radio stations, has been pulled back even more so. Financial services, auto, et cetera, has been impacted. So again, on that perspective, we've taken a pretty conservative view on the valuation. We've written it down by about 40, just over 40% from a value perspective. The way we've reflected that of that 40-odd percent is a low multiple, is about 15% of that, low EBITDA of around 17%, and an increase in net debt provisions that account for just under 10% of that 40-odd percent. Hopefully, advertising, as we all know, it's a bit of a bellwether for GDP. It is an industry that can come back relatively quickly, but certainly for now, we'll continue to manage that business through what I think will be quite difficult times for the next 6 months or so. So that gives an idea on a portfolio company. To give you an overview of the valuation, you know, on page 16. So if you talk of the capital invested, we've gone through the companies. The capital invested as at the, on a pro forma basis, as at December, assuming that the Brait deal had happened, was 2.7 billion rand. That capital invested today is 1.9 billion, so a write-down of nearly 800 million from an NAV perspective, which is reflective of the comments that we had before. Probably 500 odd of that is actually reflected in the Brait valuation reduction. So not probably about 250 of that is reflected in the Ethos Capital portfolio. From an EV, EBITDA perspective, it was at 7.4. It's reduced to 7. Now, remember, there are a couple of assets, particularly Channel VAS, Echo, and Vertice, whose multiples didn't change. So the change in the other multiples was pretty significant, around probably 20 to 25% across the portfolio. If you take the current EV EBITDA on a share price perspective, it's about 6.2%. So the implied EV EBITDA is a 6.2, including Brait. Or if you want to look to just at the Ethos Capital unlisted portfolio, the current market implies just over 5x EBITDA, you know, on that portfolio. From Ethos Capital all-in, Brait entry price was at just under 8 Rand, and our NAV per share on a pro forma basis, so assuming that the rights issue had happened as at the 31st of December, was 9.94. That has been reduced to 8.91 if we assume the Brait NAV of 8.27, or to 6.65 if you take the current prevailing Brait share price as at the 31st of March. So the final slide, just talking about the, you know, disaggregating the valuation. The 1680 was the NAV as at December 2019. We raised just over a billion rand in effectively in the Brait transaction. That was the new capital raised. From an NAV per share perspective, the NAV per share went from 1148 to 994 as part of the rights issue. But the total NAV increased to 2.692, 2.7 billion rand. The adjustments to that, as we reflected, earnings impacts had about 176 million rand reduction across the valuations. The multiple impact was 133, and the incremental net debt that we put across the portfolios added 71 million to the reduction in NAV per share. The foreign exchange movement really refers to Channel VAS. Obviously, that's a dollar asset. There was a very significant reduction in the ZAR US dollar from about, sure, I think 17 to about, was it 15 to 17, whatever the number was, probably about a 20-odd percent depreciation in the rand over that period of time, which added about 117 million rand to that. And as you can see, so that talks to the unlisted portfolio going down from an NAV perspective by 17%. The share price of Brait has fallen by 54% during that same period, from when we entered to the 31st of March, which resulted in the closing NAV of 1861 or 1.9 billion rand. So that's that brings to an end the presentation. We're very happy to have you know, questions either, you know, on the call, or alternatively, if people want to email, I'll read them out.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, if you'd like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one on your touchtone phone or the keypad on your screen. At each time, you'll hear a confirmation tone. Following this process, we'll place you in the question queue. If you decide a question has been addressed and you wish to withdraw a question, you're welcome to press star then two on your touchtone phone to remove yourself from the question queue. Once again, for the benefit of the participants who have connected via the webcast, you're welcome to pose your questions in the question box provided on your screen. Just a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one. At this stage, we have no questions from the lines. I'd like to hand over to the webcast for questions. Thank you.
Thanks. We haven't received any questions on the webcast. So, oh, wait, there's one.
Two have just come through.
The first question from Mergence. Do you think the July gym openings are possible for South Africa? Also, what's your view on Peloton and Mirror as a threat to non-SA customers of Virgin? Thank you, sir. Firstly, with respect to the gym openings in South Africa, we've made a lot of progress, to be honest, with government, and it's been a constructive engagement to date. We had the Department of Health and the DTI go through our Centurion gym probably 10 days ago. We've agreed protocols with them. We've got a panel of independents, who many of which have been nominated by the Departments of Health and DTI, who've all approved what we've done. We've signed that off with government, and really it's a question of waiting for government to sign off on it. So as we understand it, it's sitting with the minister, and we would hope that we're relatively close. You know, their various departments have signed off on it, but given the increases that we're seeing across most of the provinces, you know, we still await, you know, what government's reaction is going to be and when they will give us permission to open. But certainly from our perspective, we've pretty much done everything we can, and we can probably open, you know, with 10 days notice. So if they gave us 10 days notice, we could be open certainly by the end of the month. So we remain relatively hopeful. It's been a positive engagement to date. So, you know, we'll see. From a perspective of Peloton and Mirror, I think what we've seen is a proliferation of digital content coming out of COVID. So all of the gym operators, not just Peloton and Mirror, have put, you know, poured new content into the market. We think it's going to be quite difficult, to be honest, to monetize just the digital content. So something that you can do at home. We continue to up our game on that side. I think there's a lot of work we can still do. I think a lot of people would have seen our content during COVID that you can use at home. We're still convinced that there's two different experiences. There's the one to be done at home, the digital one. We still think the experience of going to gym, you know, hasn't gone away. We think certainly our surveys with our membership base across the globe suggest that people are very keen to get back to gyms. But we need to be mindful of the fact that there are a portion of people who will continue to work at home. I think Peloton's offering is slightly different. You know, you obviously buy at vast expense the bike, and you get very high quality content, you know, where you can, you know, cycle with, you know, whoever you want, Kevin Peterson or, you know, Jacques Cullis, et cetera. We think that is a proposition that is likely to continue to appeal to people. We have a business called Revolution. It's run out of our Italian business, extremely similar to what Peloton's offering. We have a technology partner in TechnoGym, who's one of the largest gym providers of bikes and running equipment globally. So we provide people with the bike and the same content that Peloton provides. Its launch is only in about 3 weeks' time, but it's been very successful to date already. You know, just in soft launch, we've got 1,500 subscriptions. And we think that is a business we can continue to grow. So we don't think it's necessarily at the expense of people going to gyms, but we do certainly think that there's a portion of the population who are going to continue to look to do it in that form, and we need to be up to speed as well. So we're not starting from scratch. We're a long way down the line, and anyone can Google Revolution, and you'll see, you know, the work that the team, in particularly in Italy, has done. So moving on to the next question from Excelsior Capital. How are you planning to unlock more value in Brait? We've seen the sale of Iceland Foods and DGB. Are you likely to continue with more sales? Again, a good question from our perspective. When we went into the transaction, I think we came to see many of our investors. One of the key issues that we always had was the difficulty we were going to have in selling Iceland Foods. It was a business that was 37% owned by management. But not only that, management had a controlling stake. They had more votes than Brait from when the deal was done. And we were very worried about how we could exit business, which, you know, the UK food retail space had been under pressure for a long time. So relatively fortuitously, we were a beneficiary of COVID. The business performed well, you know, in the first quarter of this year and continued, you know, into April and May. And, you know, we reached a very sensible, you know, conclusion with management to sell it back to them. We ended up selling at an 83% premium to where we held it in our books as at March. So we sold for £115 million. It was in our books at £62 million. And it certainly has given us a lot more runway from a debt perspective within Brait. We've used the proceeds to pay down the debt. DGB, again, we were very happy to get that deal done. It was done in very difficult circumstances. Trying to sell a business that's in lockdown to a new buyer is never easy, but we managed to get that deal done. And those two deals together collectively have raised 3 billion rand. The whole market cap of Brait is 4 billion rand. So we sold 10% of the asset base for 75%, you know, of the market cap. Would we look to continue? Absolutely. The strategy in Brait is to unlock value by selling the assets. But I think we need to be realistic, particularly in the case of Virgin. You know, that business is going to take, I think, 12 to 18 months to stabilize and get back to where it was, you know, on a pre-COVID basis. And we just think it wouldn't give value to shareholders to try and monetize that asset with limited transparency of where gins are likely to be. So that's an asset which, from an exit perspective, is likely to be pushed out. Pleasingly, Premier has performed very, very strongly, both absolutely, but also on a relative basis compared to its peers. It's performed very strongly. We would hope that continues. We do think that there are a number of bolt-on acquisitions we can look at for that business, particularly across our HPC platform and our confectioneries and beverages. So we'd look to do that, and we think that would help, you know, increase the multiple in that business. So probably no short-term exits necessarily out of that, out of those two, but opportunistically, you know, we will look to exit those assets and return the capital to shareholders, you know, as soon and responsibly as we can. Next question from Nedbank. Can you give us a sense of customer concentration from a telco perspective in Channel VAS? Have you had any feedback from your insurers regarding business interruption insurance? I suppose that's not to do with Channel VAS. Let me answer the second one, and if Roger's back online, he can have a go at the first one. From a business insurance perspective, obviously it's company specific. Many of our portfolio companies have applied. I think we share the same frustration that you probably read, you know, in many different guises, that the insurers have pulled their claws in and you know, have been very reluctant to pay out. I think we're going to see many, many court cases come across, you know, from that. You know, we're certainly in a number of our businesses absolutely sure that we are due the money from the insurers, and we will continue to pursue them, you know, almost at all costs to get that money back. So the feedback to date hasn't been positive from insurers. I don't think they're acting in a socially responsible manner, personally. And I think there's a long journey here. We're not alone. There's lots of people, you know, pushing the same agenda here. Are you there, Rog?
I'm here, Peter.
Do you want to talk about the customer concentration risk in Channel F?
Yes. So when we did the Channel VAS transaction, I think it was 40 or 50% of the revenues were still coming from MTN in Nigeria, which was the first market. And we were either just over the line or about to go over the line with Vodacom in South Africa. I think in the last year, we've done something like 12 billion rand in advances just through Vodacom. And it's staggering figures coming from Vodacom. So in the sort of the telco world, you've got holdcos and opcos, and the holdco would be somebody like Vodafone that owns a whole bunch of opcos, and then the opcos would be at a country level. They are both independently managed as well as got some sort of insights from the holdco level. If you sign Vodacom, it doesn't necessarily mean to say that you're going to sign Vodafone in other countries. But it does stand you in good stead. So the Vodacom success, I think, has opened up some markets for us in Africa, especially in Vodafone. And then MTN has got an internal two-vendor strategy. So even though we had MTN in Nigeria, we didn't have it in South Africa, that a competitor in South Africa. But MTN, the competitor in South Africa is not doing that well, so we get some ground there. So the customer concentration thing is a little bit of a sort of a two-edged sword. You there are some very large telcos, and it's very attractive to do well in the large telcos, but obviously we want to spread ourselves a bit as well. It's not a very clear answer, but I think we have made progress on the customer concentration perspective.
Thanks, Rog. The next question is, the recovery in IFI and Asia Pacific for Virgin Active has been very encouraging. What is the expectation for South Africa when it reopens? So it has been encouraging, I think, from two perspectives. One, the most important metric for us is, you know, how many of our members remain on freeze, which effectively means they don't, you know, if we reactivate their account, they come to us and say, look, can we freeze our account and not pay? If you look globally, that number's been somewhere between 10 and 15%, also across our portfolio. When we modeled, you know, on a post-COVID basis what the business was likely to be, we had modeled somewhere between 15 and 20%, so almost double those numbers. So I think it has been positive, you know, from a freeze perspective. And then equally positive has been the usage. You know, it, literally in Italy, every single week it's gone up by between 1 and 2%, you know, sequentially, which is very pleasing. You know, Australia was back at 100% in its suburban gyms. I think it was 94% in its suburban gyms, you know, in the 2 weeks after lockdown. So I think the key issue for us, particularly in the South African context, it's slightly different because we have the Vitality contract, which gives us, you know, a very stable income base, a contracted number that's paid across every month by Vitality, almost irrespective of whether the customers are coming to gym. So the dynamics are less volatile than the South African perspective. So we would hope that the same applies. You know, when we turn everybody and unfreeze their accounts, certainly from a Vitality perspective, we'll go back to them paying, you know, the full amount. And secondly, we would hope that the, you know, termination or freezing of memberships in SA will follow a relatively similar pattern, which would certainly be ahead of our expectations as a business. On to the next question from Graham Corner. Please, can you talk a little about the market for PE generally? Fund 7 seems to be moving quite slowly. What's expected here? Just so that you're aware, Fund 7, we actually won't raise further funds in Fund 7. The break deal was, you know, the last, you know, packet of capital that we will deploy in Fund 7 there. We didn't want to, you know, we think we've now got 6 assets in that portfolio to focus on, which we think is the right number. A lot of growing companies in there. So there's no further capital to be deployed. From a PE market generally, I think you need to look at two ways. I think it's a great time to be. It's a buyer's market. I mean, I think I alluded to it in the context of Premier, but across all of our portfolio companies, you know, Vertice is quite well advanced on a relatively large acquisition, which I think will transform the business. Premier has probably got 3 or 4 deals it's looking at, and across all of our portfolio companies, we're actively looking. We've got an investment committee next week, you know, on one of our mid-market fund companies. So I think this is a time when you can consolidate your market position in the markets that you're in and the sectors that you're in at valuations that I'm not saying you'll never see again, but certainly, you know, sellers' expectations are significantly more realistic than they were. So we think it's a great time to, particularly in our portfolio companies where you can extract synergies to be growing and buying further assets. Moving on to the next one was from David Eberl. You know, could you provide some color on the acquisition environment? As I mentioned, lots of opportunity, limited amounts of capital in the market. So, you know, we think it's a great time to be a hunter. Jared Houston from All Weather, can you give an update on the liquidity position relative to the capital commitments? Not much of an update, to be honest, Jared. It's very similar to where we were before. Obviously, valuations have come down slightly, so from a liquidity perspective from the banks, i.e. how much liquidity we could draw from the banks, that number is slightly smaller than it was. But I think we're managing our liquidity very tightly and there's nothing yet of concern, you know, on the liquidity horizon. So we continue to manage it very tightly. We have sufficient liquidity. We haven't drawn down yet or any significant amount on the RMB facility, which we will do if we need to, you know, follow our commitments. Errol Shear from Sasfin. How have the banks reacted to COVID? Has there been a tightening of covenants and spreads for private equity borrowers? Errol, it's not an easy answer, to be honest. I think it's different across the banks. You know, we've had strong partnerships with some banks who really have come to the party and looked at our portfolio holistically and are willing to say, guys, we understand this is difficult to get through and, you know, we'll back you to do it and give you the leeway that you need with no incremental costs. So that's been, I'd say, probably 50 to 60% of the experience. Look, we have come across one or two of the banks who've been, you know, extremely difficult. I think it's probably driven somewhat by their internal issues, you know, some of the smaller banks. And it's really relationship driven. So, you know, we've always said over many, many years, it's not about getting the cheapest funding into the bank. It's about getting a bank as a partner, understanding how they work and them understanding how we work. And that really has continued. So I can't say from our portfolio, you know, across most of the deals, it's been fine. We haven't really seen a tightening of covenants or there's been a relaxation. I think we're going to see that probably over the next 2 years, once COVID has passed, you know, how banks react. So for now, I think they've been more accommodating. I think the key issue will be about when you refinance those facilities, you know, is there a tightening of covenants. But for now, spreads are slightly up, but not materially so. And I think most of our companies have been very significant beneficiaries of the base rate reduction of nearly 3%. So the, Zaim from Nedbank, how will you settle the Black Hawk scheme that is currently underwater? It's relatively simple, to be honest. The company effectively owns all of those shares. We show a contingent liability effectively in our books. So it effectively, that's the net debt that you currently see, you know, see in the business. So that guarantee for to RMB on the Black Hawk facility at the end of the 5 years from now would need to be repaid if the share price hasn't increased to a level to cover the loan. So that's already shown as a contingent liability in our accounts, and we manage that under our current liquidity facility with RMB. Omri, Thomas from ABAX, Virgin has an alliance with Discovery Vitality. Can you please comment if there's been any change in the commercial relationship with Vitality? Has there been any monetary adjustment or changes to the contract with them? Omri, we've got a very strong relationship with them. It goes back many, many years. I think certainly from our marketing that we understand, it's probably the most significant draw card for Vitality customers to join up to Vitality is the fact that they get discounted memberships with Virgin. It was definitively the top last year. It has been pretty much every single year. So that it continues to be very important for Vitality, and it continues to be important for us. We renegotiated the contract probably 12 months ago, and it's been very successfully done, both for them and for us, where we changed. There used to be a joining fee of, I'm picking numbers out of the hat here around, but just under two grand, I think it was, to join, you know, irrespective of whether you were joining the Boxburg gym, which cost you 300 a month, or the Santon gym, which cost you, you know, 3,000 a month. We changed that you know, with Discovery, starting in January 2019, to effectively the joining cost was 1 month's joining fee. It was your joining fee. So if you were at Boxburg, you'd pay 300. If you were at Santon Gym, you'd pay the 3.5. And that's been very successful in increasing the customer base. As I said on the call, we saw as many customers join in the first 2 months of this year as joined in the entire 12 months of last year, which was very pleasing. So I think that relationship has been very strong. Contractually, we have a relationship with them where they have to pay us a fixed amount. We proactively went to them during the lockdown period and agreed, you know, some midway number where they continued to pay during lockdown. We could have forced them to contractually pay the full amount, but as partners, we didn't think that was the right thing to do. And I would say the relationship's as strong as ever. So it's a very important part of our business. I think it still remains a very important part of their business. I think that is all of the questions I had. One last one from Yusuf. Norma from Standard Bank. What is the perspective on portfolio construction and diversification going forward?
It's what can I say? I think we've got 27 portfolio companies, but 8 of which constitute 80-odd% of the portfolio, which we think is probably the right mix. I think diversification has helped us during COVID across our different funds for sure. But we also think it's good to have a concentration of assets that move the needle. You know, so what we wouldn't want to have is 27 companies all of 3% or 4% each. You know, we think having a concentrated portfolio of, I don't know, call it 7 to 8 to 10 companies that make up, you know, 80 to 85% of our portfolio is the right mix. So we're pretty comfortable with how it is currently. But look, we'll take it as we go, you know, depending on which opportunities arise. I think that's all of the questions that I've got. So unless there's any other questions from the group, which we're very happy to take.
Thank you very much, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, just a final reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, you're welcome to press star and then one on your touchtone phone to place yourself in the question queue. And so we have no further questions from the lines.
Okay. Thanks very much again to everyone. Again, we really appreciate your support.
I know it's been tough times for
for everyone. We would hope that things are brighter going forward from here, but we really appreciate your support, and feel free at any point to call us. You don't need to wait for a quarterly update. We're very open, very happy to take calls from anyone as we go. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's conference. Thank you for joining us. You may now disconnect your lines.